From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A major new report by a top U.S. Army War College analyst argues that the United States has no grand strategy that's working in its war on terrorism. Grand words from the Bush White House, yes, but no grand follow-through. An ungrounded U.S. approach to the campaign on terror, says the report's author, is taking a heavy toll in terms of lives lost and billions of dollars spent. The United States, he says, faces a stark choice. Either stand up with a lot more troops and cash and really go after the roots of terrorism, or stand down and accept that some terrorism will always exist. Each option has its pros and cons, says the report, but talking big and straddling, it says, is not working, and it's dangerous. Tonight on Point, a tough War College assessment of American grand strategy in the war on terror. And later in this hour, we'll get reaction to Mark Felt coming forward as Deep Throat, the source who fed the Watergate investigation that led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon. But first, we begin tonight in Washington with the latest on a Bush administration review of its campaign against international terrorism as the United States moves away from its post-9/11 strategy of capturing al-Qaeda leaders to a broader strategy of rooting out violent extremism. Under review, how to handle a new generation of terrorists coming out of Iraq. Susan Glasser covers terrorism for The Washington Post. She joins me now. Susan Glasser, thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So they're talking about a phase two being defined in this review. What's going on, Susan?
Well, I think that this is, in a way, a natural interregnum, right? This is after Bush's reelection, sort of moving beyond the politicization a little bit of the election year campaign questions about what is the war on terror and, you know, trying to regroup and understand how has al-Qaeda changed, transformed, and, you know, maybe even morphed into something unrecognizable since September of 2001.
Now, you've talked with Frances Fragos Townsend, a woman at the heart, I guess, of the National Security Council effort here. And how is she describing the shift in gears that's underway or that's been laid out? Tell us exactly what's happened.
Well, I mean, as with most things concerning the war on terror, I think there's an enormous amount that we don't know about this and a great reluctance on the part of the administration to spell out in detail what they're talking about beyond broad contours, especially since this is an ongoing review. But it's significant in bureaucratic terms because this is the first such policy review since the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. And I think the idea here is to come up with, you know, some actual new guiding precepts, possibly in the form of a presidential national security directive. So that's actually a big deal in Washington terms, although they're by definition quite vague, it seems to me, about what they're really about.
Explain what that might mean in institutional terms, a new presidential directive.
Well, for example, if you go back and look at the 9/11 Commission report, you know, and its, you know, really celebrated and deep probing look at what happened leading up to the September 11 terrorist attacks, you'll find an enormous amount written there about the efforts of Dick Clark and other counterterrorism people within the government to get the attention of President Bush and to produce such a directive. So I think that gives you a sense of why it's considered important in bureaucratic terms. This is the thing, the very thing that they were trying to do before September 11th, because it's the way in which national policy is set and focused, and it sort of drives people much farther down the food chain.
You quote a senior administration official, unnamed, saying, "What we really want now is a strategic approach to defeat violent extremism." Mm-hmm. I would have thought that would have been what they wanted some years ago already.
Well,
I don't mean it exactly facetiously, but what's the change there?
I think you're right to ask those questions, and I think part of the issue here is that people have not been able to ask a lot of questions about what is the nature of this war on terrorism. But also, I think that's an effort to respond to some of the critics who said a war on terrorism is, by definition, it's a war against a technique, a tactic, it's not against people. I think, in a way, to me, what that suggests is actually a broadening of this, saying that it's not just terrorism, that we're going to look more broadly at the support base, the roots, the recruiting networks that make support for Islamic radical terrorism possible. So to me, that's what that indicates. But they haven't sat down and spelled it out to anyone.
You also describe Francis Townsend as saying the enemy has adapted, and there's a reference in your report to concern over terrorists not being sort of gathered up on flypaper in Iraq, but rather being trained in Iraq and coming back out into the world. Is there a concern there?
Absolutely. I mean, as I've been talking to counterterrorism experts inside and outside of the government in recent weeks, I've heard that expressed from all of them. A great concern right now about Iraq, as a recent State Department report put it, a melting pot for jihadists, not just, you know, as you said, being caught up and stuck in Iraq, but I think that's the great concern, is that there may be a new generation of fighters being trained there in Iraq, and eventually, at some point, many of them will go home or go to other places.
Well, Susan Glasser, you've certainly got our attention. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
Susan Glasser, a reporter for The Washington Post. She spoke with me from Washington. We are talking tonight about America's grand strategy on terrorism with a top U.S. Army War College analyst who says it is not working. It's time, he says, to either put more resources into the war or to change direction. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you think the United States has a strategy in the war on terror that's actually working? Is Washington talking big without the follow-through to make its efforts count? And can the U.S. afford to follow through on the strategy its current rhetoric would require? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, is Stephen Biddle. He's Associate Professor of National Security Studies at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. He is author of the new report, American Grand Strategy After 9/11 and Assessment. Stephen Biddle, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to have you on.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Biddle.
Stephen Biddle, please give us the heart of your critique here. We really want to know what you found. It's 50 pages, big report, and it's making waves. What are you saying?
Well, I think it's important to point out that the grand strategy we've got is incomplete. I mean, there are some very important questions. Who's the enemy? What's our objective against that enemy? That more than 3 years into the war, we still haven't pinned down. I would not say, though, that the grand strategy has been unsuccessful. I can't know that. I don't think anyone else knows that. I think one of the big and probably unanswerable questions at the moment, given that we're fighting an enemy as shadowy as certainly Al-Qaeda is whether or not we're on a successful track or not. I think what we've got as we pursue the path that we're pursuing is a larger plan that's missing some key pieces. Now, that's not to say that we're going to fail. That's not to say that we aren't on the way to success. In fact, there's a certain tendency among academic-y sorts like me to point out, you know, platonic ideals of completely consistent, you know, completely systematic strategies that we would like governments like ours to adopt. In the real world of messy, incomplete information, multiple agencies struggling over outcomes, no grand strategy, not ours right now, not ours in World War II, has ever been complete and systematic. What we need to do, I think, is to move our strategy as close as we can to something like an ideal, complete, and consistent strategy. That's not to say that any strategy that falls short of that is hopeless or unsuccessful or unprecedented.
Stephen Biddle, I've got to ask you, you've got a lot of experience here, very high-ranking analyst, but I just wonder from the tone of your opening there. I mean, I'm reading some tough things in the report you've put out. Mm-hmm. Headlines reporting on your report saying Bush strategy lacks clarity, report asserts. Have you been taken to the woodshed by the administration since your report hit the newspapers?
No, my rear end is unpaddled as of right now. No, I have not been suppressed or pushed back against in any way that I can detect. But the report as I wrote it doesn't say that the strategy is unsuccessful. It says that the strategy is incomplete, and it's terribly important that we make it complete, and that we do so pronto, because costs are mounting rapidly in the course of the Iraqi insurgency. The time has come to make these kinds of choices, and it's been quite a while now without those choices being made. More time has gone by, for example, between September 11, 2001, and now, than went by between December 7, 1941, Pearl Harbor and VE Day in Europe.
Jack Beatty, Stephen Biddle is parsing his words very carefully here, but I read in this report, in the 3 years since 9/11, the administration has yet to arrive at a clear definition of the enemy or the aim in the war on terrorism. That doesn't sound like a brilliant passing grade from the War College professor.
Well, fortunately, they're not enrolled in the War College, so I don't have to grade them. But it is the fact, and a terribly important fact, that we have not yet clearly identified the enemy. We have not yet clearly identified what our objective is against that enemy. And the strategies we should choose change as a function of how ambitious our objectives are against that enemy. It matters that this choice is unmade.
Jack, you've dipped into this report. What do you see?
Well, Professor Biddle draws a sort of two basic strategies, rollback and containment. And rollback, basically the idea that in order to be safe from terrorism, we have to change the nature of the Middle East. We have to either ourselves change regimes or put pressure on the regimes to democratize so as to dry up terrorism at the roots. That's one option. And the other option is containment, that we pretty much accept that there's going to be stability in the Middle East. These regimes aren't going to change overnight, and we're going to have to live with that and with the resulting, perhaps, terrorism generated by the repression. Well, rollback looked like an awfully much more credible strategy 3 years ago, before we went into Iraq. Now it beguiles belief to think that that this country could credibly advocate regime change pretty much anywhere in the world, but in the Arab world, I'm afraid regime change would be something tantamount to a nuclear exchange in the Cold War, given the war on civilization, war of civilizations motif that surrounds everything.
Jack Beatty, Stephen Biddle, please stand by. A lot we've got to dig in here tonight. We're talking about America's grand strategy on terrorism with an Army College war analyst who says it just needs a lot more clarification. You can join the conversation tonight. Does the U.S. have a strategy in the war on terrorism that's actually working? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's grand strategy on terrorism with an Army War College analyst who says it's in need of getting real, that America must pour more resources into the Middle East or pull back. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Is Washington talking big without the follow-through to make its efforts count? And does America have to change the Middle East to be secure itself against terrorism? Or could it live with the region and contain terror? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight, Stephen Biddle, Associate Professor of National Security Studies, U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. He's author of the new report, American Grand Strategy After 9/11, An Assessment, and it is a tough assessment. He is telling us tonight that no grand strategy is easy to put together or easy to make work, but time is ticking by. Stephen Biddle, as I read you, essentially saying, let's pull up our socks here, let's tighten our focus, and please pick up on what Jack was just beginning to lay out there, your notion that there's a choice that must be made about whether we're going to remake the Middle East with democracy or choose an option of containment. What are the options there?
Well, I think those are the two key alternatives we face at the moment, and which one makes the most sense depends on what your objective is in the war. If your objective in the war is to come somewhere close to elimination of terrorism as a tactic in the world, it is going to require essentially the political reconstruction of the Mideast. If, on the other hand, we're willing to tolerate, for example, a level of terrorism of the kind that was typical in the world prior to September 11, we might be able to get by without that degree of sweeping political reconstruction of an entire region and settle, for example, for a very aggressive effort to keep terrorists from getting weapons of mass destruction. So we would seek access controls on existing nuclear weapons, elaborate non-proliferation regimes, covert action to disrupt proliferation programs, possibly security guarantees to potential proliferators, a variety of other much more moderate means that can reasonably be expected to produce moderate but only moderate results.
Is, in other words, no complete prophylactic against terrorism, but contain it, control it, keep it down.
Yeah, it would require us to tolerate a level of terrorism that still kills Americans on a fairly regular basis, but does not produce mushroom clouds over major American cities.
Now, the critique that I read implicit and almost explicit here is that the Bush administration has been straddling, that it really hasn't made this choice. You say it has to. It's come to the point where fundamental choices, in your words, can no longer be deferred.
I think that's correct.
And what's the evidence of the straddle?
Well, we had no public statement by the U.S. government has identified, for example, who the enemy is or what our objective is in a way that's clear. I mean, for example, lots of people suppose that the enemy in the war on terror is al-Qaeda. The government, however, has explicitly and repeatedly said that that's not their interpretation of who the enemy is. I mean, for example, the September 2002 National Security Strategy says the enemy is not a single political regime or person or religion or ideology. The enemy is terrorism. Al-Qaeda is not the only terrorist network that threatens us. It's clear that the administration sees the enemy as more than just Al-Qaeda. What's not clear is how much more than just Al-Qaeda is it. And among the problems that raises is it runs the risk of creating for ourselves unnecessary enemies. Terrorists, by and large, have a very hard time cooperating with each other. I mean, after all, they're illegal organizations to begin with. They're very mistrustful of outsiders, and their objectives are typically very local. The IRA, for example, wants a Catholic government in Northern Ireland. Mm. Hamas wants the elimination of Israel and the establishment of a Palestinian state. Given that their own interests are very local and they don't trust outsiders, they typically have a very hard time cooperating with each other. Now the United States sails in and makes statements that could easily be interpreted as saying that the only difference we see among one terrorist group and another terrorist group is the order in which we mean to destroy them. And that provides an important kicker that could very well be just the lubrication that's needed for groups that have a very hard time cooperating with each other to do just that.
For kind of the United States of terror congealing there.
Yeah, we're on the risk of making enemies for ourselves that we otherwise might be able to drive wedges between and isolate rather than bringing together.
President Bush and others around him have talked a lot about this political transformation of the Middle East, about the vision of spreading democracy there. You say that the U.S. has failed to apply the necessary resources to actually pull that off. Where do you see the shortfall?
Well, I mean, I think the issue is actually less how much money we're spending and more what our objective is. The discussion about Iraq tends to focus, I suppose understandably, on Iraq itself. But in terms of grand strategy, Iraq is not the point. The point is Arab Mideastern states outside Iraq. I mean, the September 11 terrorists, after all, were not Iraqi citizens. The issue is political reconstruction in other places.
We get that, and I think President Bush has been rather clear about that, and that's my question to you. If that's the goal, and that I think that's what most Americans assume the president means, what's the shortfall in resources that you're referring to?
Well, and again, I think the issue is less one of resources than one of risk.
Risk.
I mean, it's great if democracy spreads through the Mideast without further conflict. That would be wonderful. It's entirely possible that it won't work that way. Nobody at the moment knows for sure how it's going to work, but at least one distinct possibility is that other Arab police states decide not to democratize. And if we really want that to happen, it will require some degree of forceful effort by the United States.
So you're not only saying that it's resource shy, but that it's a bad idea, that it's too risky.
I'm saying it's definitely very risky. Whether it's too risky depends on what your objective is in the war, how low you think you need to force the threat of terrorism. If you're willing to accept a significant amount of terrorism against Americans, if you're willing to tolerate that, then you probably assess the risk level in democratizing the entire Mideast is too high. If, on the other hand, you believe that we really do need to get the threat of terrorism down to something real close to zero, then the only way to get that is a strategy that requires that you accept a high-risk plan for the Mideast.
And if the United States goes the other direction in this fundamental choice you describe and chooses containment, how would the execution of that look different from what's going on right now?
Well, I think, for example, we could accept a strong man in Iraq. We would not require a democracy in the country. For that matter, we could accept a substantial amount of kind of ongoing chronic insurgency in the country for the long haul. If we're not trying to cause Iraq to be a shining example that leads to a democratic domino effect elsewhere in the region, if we're willing to tolerate police states throughout the Mideast, and what we're really interested in is just cap the threat at less than weapons of mass destruction, somehow prevent terrorists from getting a hold of nuclear weapons, then we can tolerate a much less ambitious outcome in Iraq.
Jack Beatty, I wonder if we're hearing the latticework put up here for a kind of stand down on Iraq. It sounds like it.
Well, the logic of it would be that this is a bridge too far, that we are unable, we proved ourselves unable to police a 10-mile road linking the green zone with the airport. That's what we have shown our power to be in Iraq. Now, admittedly, it's an asymmetrical warfare and so on, but that has certainly hurt the credibility of our power everywhere and thus weakened the rollback option considerably. An adaptation to reality might well be, wait a minute, is democracy really what we want in Iraq when democracy is going to result in the marginalization of the Sunnis, who are the people who are offering the belligerency in the insurgency? Is that really what we want, or do we want rather stability in Iraq, which, of course, we had with Saddam? The Iraq isn't going to make trouble for its neighbors, but on the other hand, it isn't going to fall apart. Here are the risks that we have undertaken here. What was Colin Powell's metaphor? It's the pottery barn metaphor. We've broken a lot of crockery, and whether it's going to come together in a democracy, whether it's going to come together in another authoritarian state, whether it's going to fragment into a civil war, all of this, these were the risks we undertook, and it's so clear that we are beyond being able to manage those risks now.
Well, that may be, Jack, but on the other hand, after all the rhetoric of the last 4 years now, aren't Americans more than a little bit pregnant with this idea that only democratizing the Middle East can safely secure the United States against terrorism?
They perhaps are. I think that idea, which was a kind of subordinate idea to ending the threat of weapons of mass destruction, supposedly possessed by Saddam, I think that caught on with people. That Wilsonianism impulse is really basic in American political culture. The trouble with it is that it runs it flies in the face of realities, and what we haven't heard, either from the Democrats, because they're afraid to come out and say, well, wait a minute, do we really have to have democracy everywhere? Or from the Republicans, the realistic foreign policy, the foreign policy that says, listen, you can't really deal with the internal workings of states. What you have to be concerned with is their external behavior. Let's leave it at that. We have interests in this region. It has to do with oil. We've got along for 50 years without democracy, and we got our oil. We can still do it.
So bring on the strong men and bring down the hammer somehow, miraculously, whenever a weapon of mass destruction begins to emerge. I want to begin to bring our callers into this conversation. Jim is calling from North Bergen, New Jersey. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
I'm amazed I got through. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
It's great to have you.
I have a real problem with just our entire approach to this. The fact that we use the word war on terrorism, to the Europeans and to the Russians and to people who have experienced real war, this is a real problem for them. And if this had been portrayed as a global police action, which is really what we need resources poured into intelligence, you know, all the intelligence agencies that are getting short shift.
But Jim, do we get to decide?
Didn't money on going into this dramatic war?
Well, let me ask you, Jim. Didn't 9/11 look like an act of war to you, or do you think it was just visuals off of a tiny base? Didn't merit a war response?
I saw it myself. I live right across the the river from it. And when the police turned me around at the George Washington Bridge, I went to the cliffs and I saw towers burning and falling down. So, yes, it did look like an act of war. I think Afghanistan was perfectly justified. I'm a little questionable as to whether or not Saddam Hussein couldn't have been gotten out of power some other way.
And could we turn to police action here? Jim, I want to put that, our time is growing short here. I want to put that to Stephen Biddle. Is that part of what you're suggesting, Stephen Biddle? A police action instead of the war metaphor, or the new acronym now I see here in the reports out of the White House, GWOT, GWOT, Global War on Terrorism. War or police action?
Well, I mean, I think we've clearly declared a war. That's one of the decisions that we did make clear from the beginning, and that the strategy has been quite unambiguous about. Lots of people thought it was a bad idea at the time. Lots of people think it's a good idea at the
time. But is it a rhetorical flourish, or is it a reality?
No, it's quite a reality. We've fought two campaigns in this war so far. I mean, people are dying right now because of an interpretation that this is a war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a war whose intensity level is higher than the American military was built for, but arguably lower than you might need in order to bring about a really demanding objective against a broadly defined enemy. But I think it's safe to characterize what we've got as a war. I think the key issue is how intense should it be, and for what objectives should it be fought.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring another voice into this conversation, if I may. Joining us from Washington, Thomas Mankin. He's a visiting fellow at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins Institute. Areas of research include American defense policy, military power, strategy. He's an officer in the U.S. Naval Reserve, author of Uncovering Ways of War. Thomas Mankin, thanks for joining us tonight.
Glad to be with you.
So Stephen Biddle is soft-pedaling a little bit tonight, but he's got some tough language in here, talking about the administration having yet to arrive at a clear definition of the enemy or the aim in the war on terrorism. That sounds like a tough critique. Talking about ambiguity on critical particulars in this effort, talking about fundamental choices that can no longer be deferred. Do you see a kind of fundamental problems at the heart of the current grand strategy or the way it's being kept up to date as we have an evolving understanding of the world, Thomas Mankin?
Well, look, I mean, I actually share, Steve Biddle's critique to a certain extent that the administration has not been precise in its language, its definition of the threat that we face. But I have to say that that's a certain amount of that is understandable. If the president were to come out and say, you know, our enemy is a particularly virulent strain of radical Islam, and we need to combat that, then he would be confirming in the minds of many what they already see as a clash of civilizations, as an ideological religious war. So, you know, for public consumption, the administration has to tap dance around these things.
But has that left the country kind of straddling between, on the one hand, not just rhetorically, but in its inner workings, its inner understanding of what it's up to, between a policy of remaking the Middle East, if necessary, to sort of wipe out the seedbed of terrorism, on the one hand, or on the other hand, as Stephen Biddle describes, an alternate option, to step back a bit and pursue a policy of containment. Instead, is the U.S. kind of dangling somewhere between the two and doing neither really effectively?
Well, I think we are in a period where our strategy is forming and evolving. I mean, if the analogy that we choose is not World War II, but the early post-World War II years, the early years of the Cold War, early on, things were, you know, our strategy was formed in terms of communism, a war against communism. Just as we talk about a war on terrorism, over time, you know, we came to have a much sharper view of things and really see that we were concerned about Soviet communism and Soviet power. And you know, I would expect this type of evolution to go on within the government and within the broader debate.
Stephen Biddle, I have to say there's an urgency in your work that I don't entirely hear in that critique. These fundamental choices that you say can no longer be deferred, you describe great costs associated with not making fundamental important choices. Describe those costs for us.
Well, financially, we're spending, I've seen figures, $4 to $6 billion a month waging war in Iraq, plus the expenditures in Afghanistan. Perhaps most importantly, people's lives are being lost every day as a result of the condition that we find ourselves in. Now, if the condition we find ourselves in, waging a counterinsurgency simultaneously in Iraq and Afghanistan, is necessary in order to bring about an objective that's clear and we've understood and decided as a nation that we want, then that cost makes sense. Those lives are being, you know, lost in a sensible approach. If, in fact, we don't know what our objective is, then the question of whether or not costs that we're incurring are being well incurred, I think, is unanswered. And I think it's incumbent on us to go about, as a society, not just as a government. This is a decision that the electorate as a whole, at the end of the day, has to make. We need to get on with it.
Jack Beattie, Stephen Biddle, and Thomas Mankin both expressing understanding for the difficulty of this, and yet the stakes are so large, you would think this many years after 9/11, we would have more clarity than Stephen Biddle describes.
Yes. First of all, it was, of course, keeping weapons of mass destruction out of the hands of terrible people. That has shifted, and we have the new one of democratization. But of course, if you start to talk on that line, you've got to, you know, look straight at Saudi Arabia, our ally. You've got to essentially impugn its state religion. You've got to, you know, point out that it is just recently it jailed a bunch of people who dared to write critical editorials about it, jailed them for 10 years. You have to look at our ally Egypt, which just grudgingly is allowing opposition in this national election, but really is freezing the Islamists completely out of power, as if it's just determined to go the way of Algeria. What can we do there? So, yes, if we start talking too much about this, we alienate the people, we alienate our allies.
Jack Beatty, Stephen Biddle, Thomas Mencken, please stand by. We're talking tonight about America's grand strategy on terrorism. You can join us. What do you think? Does America have to change the Middle East to be secure itself against terrorism? Or could it live with the region and contain terror? Does the Bush administration have the big picture right on how to deal with terrorism? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's grand strategy on terrorism with an Army War College analyst who says it's in need of getting real, that America must pour more resources into the Middle East or pull back, that there are fundamental decisions to be made. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Are the White House and Pentagon in too deep to change their approach? And what does it mean if the country doesn't have a realistic, affordable, well-defined strategy behind its rhetoric? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty's with us tonight. We're also joined by Stephen Biddle, Associate Professor of National Security Studies at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute, author of the new report, American Grand Strategy After 9/11, An Assessment. And from Washington by Thomas Mencken, visiting fellow at the School of Advanced International Studies at John Hopkins Institute. David's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I want to thank Professor Biddle for his report and for his comments tonight. And I know he said he hasn't experienced any retaliation so far, but I hope he has some career prospects at hand, because this is precisely the kind of clear-eyed, hard-nosed analysis that has cut careers short in this government. Just looking back, just in the last week, in the report in the Baltimore Sun this Sunday about a general who spoke up, and well, there were other reasons that were put before him, but was forced into early retirement.
So better be hoping for tenure there at the Army War College, David. You're saying
he already has tenure, and I'm thankful in general for the War College, because they've done some good hard-nosed analysis before this, but I can't imagine that there won't be some seriously ticked off people.
David, let us pick it up. Stephen Biddle, how about it? We know where General Shinseki headed off to. What's your sense of the quality of the conversation inside the administration, between the administration and strategic thinkers, military thinkers? Are these questions being adequately, openly addressed and dealt with? Is the strategy being challenged and refined on the right kind of timetable?
Well, I mean, I think the fact that we're having this conversation right now means that dissent is taking place.
Well, we're having it, but have you had it with Don Rumsfeld?
Don Rumsfeld so far hasn't invited me to lunch. I don't normally have lunch with secretaries of defense. I would welcome it if he decided to. But my sense is that War College writings are read at senior levels. I mean, I don't know whether this one has been read by the secretary, but I know others have. I'm hopeful that this is a contribution that might help shape the debate within the senior reaches of the government. But at the end of the day, my role as an academic is to call it like I see it and hope that they listen and hold sessions like this to encourage them to listen. But that's ultimately their call.
Tom Mencken, what's your sense of this administration? How well it listens, how well it examines its own approach? I mean, there is some tough criticism in here. Do you think this kind of internal questioning goes on. And are you confident that we're really on the right beam? I know you expressed a kind of generosity of spirit toward the, you know, the ambiguities of wartime and how long it takes to get things buttoned up just right. But should the American people be satisfied with the pace of getting focused, of cutting out ambiguity, of cutting to the chase?
Well, no, look, we clearly need not just a debate within the U.S. government, but we need a national debate on our strategy for what is going to be a protracted war. I mean, if we are to win this war, we will win it, you know, not as Republicans, not as Democrats, but as a country. And so what we need to do is forge a bipartisan consensus that will carry us through this war, like the type of basic consensus that was forged and that saw us through the Cold War.
But we don't just want a consensus, we want the right consensus. I mean, it can't just be built around sort of attractive sounding phrases.
No, but of course it's through discussion, through dialogue, through debate that a good consensus, a durable consensus, is forged. And I think, as Dr. Biddle said, I mean, I think this is the start of what needs to go on.
Larry's calling from Cary, North Carolina. Hi, Larry, you're on the air.
Yeah, I think your commentators are making a lot more sense than you or Jack Beatty are making. I mean,
well, don't hold back, Larry. Let me have it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you certainly don't hold back in your show. I have to say that we have to look upon this as an emerging strategy. We were caught by surprise. We were caught flat-footed, and this administration and several prior administrations were in the wrong in that regard. We all recognize that. But the unfolding strategy is actually quite an interesting one. We have seen some significant victories. We've seen some significant defeats. We've seen some significant highs and significant lows. I think the one thing I haven't heard your strategist talking about tonight is the multiplier factor of the populations of the Middle East. Having spent a lot of time in the Middle East myself, I am very sure that we are going to see some extraordinary developments in the Middle East, similar to those that we experienced in a few days as we began to realize the implications of the Iraqi election. And I think Jack Beatty declaring a defeat early on reminds me very solidly of the kind of commentaries we were hearing when the American armies were in North Africa sustaining severe difficulties at the hands of the Germans.
So, open the box of democracy and tap that multiplier effect of people, the people in the Middle East. Stephen Biddle, how about it? Larry's saying, you know, he likes your line of approach here. He thinks I'm over the top with it. But do you see a multiplier effect waiting to come in like the cavalry over the hill to assist the United States in the Middle East? Is it enough to talk and probe and prod and imagine that we'll be aided by a kind of positive democratic upsurge that would support the White House strategy?
I hope so. With all my heart, I hope the caller is right. I think the problem is none of us knows for sure, and what we've got then is a calculation about risk. Pursuing political reengineering in the Mideast might work, but it might not. It's very high risk, it's high payoff if it works, and it's very high cost if it fails.
Bottom line, we've just got a couple of minutes left tonight. If you were to advise the president this evening, would you say stick with the political reengineering, your phrase, of the Middle East, or go to the containment policy?
The great virtue of being an academic is I can be on the one hand and on the other hand. The main point I want to make tonight is not that we should do containment or we should do rollback, but A, we got to choose, and B, there are real downsides to both of them.
Thomas Mankin, we've just got a minute left. Do you see the administration moving toward a choice?
Well, I actually think that the choice between rollback and containment is a false one. Because I really don't see that containment is a realistic option. Certainly not of the type of containment that we had in the Cold War, and certainly, I mean, I think that the notion of quote unquote stability in the Middle East is a chimera that it's something that we've been chasing for decades now, and I think it's actually I think containment based on this optimism towards stability is misplaced.
Jack Beatty, we've got half a minute here. Maybe containment's too tall an order, but clarity certainly, clarity of goal, I think all Americans would like to see.
Yes, who is the enemy and what do we want to accomplish? And these are big questions, and that they haven't been answered for all that we've hedged about it. That does make one think that there's a kind of intellectual vacuum at the heart of this war, as well as a vacuum of resources committed to the goals.
Stephen Biddle, we appreciate your pouring your intellectual work right into that space and appreciate your being with us tonight. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Biddle at the U.S. Army War College, author of the new report, American Grand Strategy After 9/11, an assessment, and Thomas Mankin at Johns Hopkins Institute. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Glad to be with you.
In a moment, the long secret identity of Watergate's deep throat is revealed. This is On Point. Today, the identity of Deep Throat, the government informant who helped Washington Post reporters Robert Woodward and Carl Bernstein break the story of Watergate and bring down Richard Nixon, was revealed. W. Mark Felt, the former number two man at the FBI, acknowledged in an article in Vanity Fair that he is Deep Throat. Later in the day, Woodward and Bernstein confirmed the story. The identity of Deep Throat has long been the subject of speculation among journalists and politicians. Today, Ben Bradley, the Post's executive editor during Watergate, said, "The thing that stuns me is that the secret has lasted this long." Joining me now is John Dean, former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon. John Dean, thank you for being with us tonight.
Pleasure, Tom.
Also with us, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. John Dean, first to you, just your response, your reaction to the unveiling today.
Well, I actually was surprised because it doesn't seem to me, I don't know how Mark Felt got access to the information that Deep Throat had, particularly since some of the most sensitive information comes at the very end. For example, the fact that there's an erasure on some of the tapes. That's in the first week of November of 1973. I think Felt is out of the FBI at that point. So as I say, I don't know how he got some of this information, whether it's double, triple hearsay that he's got. And also I'm surprised that here's a man who told Woodward that this is information the FBI is not aware of, yet he is the man who is the head of the FBI investigation of Watergate. That's something of an oxymoron, if you think about it. How can the man who's running the investigation talk about things that the FBI doesn't know, yet he knows them? That raises problems about whether he was being candid with the investigation that he was actually privy to.
So, John Dean, just so I understand, are you expressing skepticism about the Mark Felt's coming out as Deep Throat? Are you saying maybe not?
I'm not. I don't doubt Woodward Woodward is clearly the only person who can make this identification.
Yeah.
They flip-flopped today. They first initially, the story ran for many, many hours until they finally said, yes, we won't take our standard. We won't comment until after he's dead. They obviously were under pressure from the Post because somebody else was running with their story. And so they decided to come forward with it and confirm it. But now, in doing so, for example, Bob Woodward, and I've talked about this over the years, and he'd always told me, he said, John, it is one person, I assure you that. He also said, when you hear the name and learn who it is, it'll be something of an epiphany for you. You say, I understand now. Well, exactly the opposite is my reaction. I don't understand at all, because I don't think Felt could have had access to a lot of the information.
Jack Beatty, John Dean was right there in the heart of all this, former White House counsel for President Nixon. At last, the clouds part. Here's Deep Throat, Mark Felt, and he's befuddled.
I guess the issue is, what motive did he have? Well, one is indicated in his 1979 memoir about the FBI. He wrote, J. Edgar Hoover had just died a few weeks before Watergate, and the question was who was going to take his place, and Felt was number three in the Bureau. And he wrote, my own record was good, and I allowed myself to think I had an excellent chance. Well, he wasn't named. Patrick Gray was named, an outsider, and this apparently really shocked people at the FBI. Jim Mann, the reporter for the Los Angeles Times, wrote a piece for my magazine, The Atlantic Monthly, years ago, in which he pretty much said it had to be Felt or one or two other people in the FBI, not for this personal motive, you didn't name me, but for the institutional motive, that the FBI had been cut out of this. The president, within 3 days of the break-in, ordered the CIA to tell the FBI to butt out, and that this was an insult to the FBI, as was putting Patrick Gray, an outsider, into J. Edgar Hoover's mausoleum.
John Dean,
I don't disagree with anything that Jack said,
yes.
Tom, but let me just add this.
Please.
In the motive department, if Felt was running, and Felt was running the Bureau on a day-to-day basis when Pat Gray came in, Pat Gray didn't have a clue of how to run the place, and so he had to rely on somebody like Felt. How can Felt be running the FBI and be arranging or himself circulating the New York Times on page 20 indicating he wants to visit with Woodward, or checking Woodward's flower pot on his balcony to see if a flag is in it, signaling that Woodward wants to talk to him? It raises the question that did Felt have other people in the Bureau assisting him, and was it indeed maybe something that the Bureau was really, it's more of a composite than we think, even through Felt, because I don't know how Felt does this alone.
That makes it sound like a kind of a putsch, a kind of a mini coup orchestrated out of the FBI.
You got it.
Well, Jack, there's a way of framing it. There's a charge.
And it was just the kind of thing that President Nixon would have suspected.
It's a coup.
A plot.
I've got to tell you that the Felt would be no surprise to Nixon. I had a conversation with him, I think, on February 27th or 28th. We got in one of the recorded conversations where we got into a national security leak that Time magazine had. And we'd been told pretty much by the FBI, our insiders there, that it was Felt. Nixon, I guess some of the tapes have been around now on Felt, where he has a fairly low estimation of Felt, because he was a well-known source within the White House. We knew he was leaking information.
But Nixon didn't believe that he was the ultimate source in this case.
He didn't know. He always thought it was somebody who wanted to have a career with the media, and for that reason, he had been motivated to leak.
Jack Beatty, remind us of the major names that have effectively been cleared with this unveiling today.
Well, I think one of them, and John, you may have written this, one of the big suspects for years was Pat Buchanan, and that Pat's motive was, Pat was a speechwriter to President Nixon, and that his motive was that Nixon really was softening the Cold War, was having a kind of truce with the Soviet Union, detente, had recognized China, and even in domestic policy was a fairly liberal president, and that Pat, on ideological grounds, wanted to undo him.
Yeah, Pat would have made a perfect one motive-wise, and knowledge of how the press operates, knew how Washington operated, knew where their little sleepy places, bars, to have drinks with a source. So all this is, you know, there's still a lot of unanswered questions, and we also take off the list people like Bill Sapphire has been a possibility for years. David Gergen was a source. I have been named. Kissinger's been named. Mm. Everybody has been through the mill at one time or another. And what's most surprising to me, I'm very aware of the great piece that Jim Mann wrote for The Atlantic. I'm a longtime subscriber.
1992.
Right. He really nailed it. And in that piece, as I recall, Felt said, I think it was in that piece, that he said that had he been Deep Throat, he wouldn't have made all the mistakes that Deep Throat made. And that's one of the problems. Much of the information that we know that from Woodward that he got from Deep Throat is just dead wrong. Maybe as much, and I've taken it fact by fact, or I call them factoids, and about half of them are dead wrong. And now what motivates a Mark Felt to... He had to know some of this information was highly speculative, and it's not cast that way at all in the way Bob treats it.
Well, right or wrong, he's public tonight. W. Mark Felt, number two man at the FBI, as Deep Throat. John Dean, former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Always a pleasure.
And Jack, pleasure. Jack Beatty, wonderful to have you on as well. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.